Blog Talk Radio.
In the desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. I want to wish everyone a very, very, very happy new year. Happy new year to you, Mary, in the chat room, and others will be joining her soon. I'm so excited for another opportunity that the Lord has given me in this new year to be a voice of hope and freedom to Iranians all over the world as refugees. I'm thinking of my dear friend Maral this morning and where she's at, safe. Very thankful God has answered prayers for her, praying for her case to be heard so that her and her son can have a brand new home away from fear and oppression of the Iranian government. I want to say a special word this morning about what the cross in the desert is all about. I know that many of my friends, and I get more every day, are not acquainted with the radio broadcast. And so when they look at the name, the cross in the desert, they may pause and want to know why. Well, I have a copy of my book in my hands, which is the publication from actually last November. It's called The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. And on the front cover, you see a picture of Rahane Jabari. I dedicated this book to her just right after her execution. And, of course, this book is a voice of hope for my Iranian friends. Many of the stories in here are their actual stories that I've reworked the English a little bit and put in my own words. But what I want to center in on this morning is the reason why I call this program The Cross in the Desert. And I'm reading from page 3 of my book, and here's why. I love to paint with words. I want the reader to feel and taste what I write. I want to draw my readers into another world where they can explore and imagine with all of their senses. The image of a dry, hot, treacherous desert with sweltering, unbearable heat is the perfect way for me to introduce the cool and refreshing rivers of living waters for the desperate traveler who is dying of thirst. Quote, O God, you are my God. I earnestly search for you. My soul thirsts for you. My whole body longs for you in this parched and weary land where there is no water. Psalm 63, verse 1. The imagery of this psalm introduces the weary traveler who is longing presence of God. The traveler is desperately searching, zealously desiring to reconnect with his God. He realizes that his life is empty without the presence of God. The traveler is suffering from despair and crying out with his whole being for relief. All of us can relate to this desperate condition. I chose this name for my blogs and my radio program to paint a picture, to entice and draw the readers out of their mundane existence and give them a longing for finding their purpose and fulfillment in life. Sometimes our life seems meaningless and empty and without purpose. We feel like we are trapped under the scorching heat of a desert, thirsting and longing for a new beginning. In the midst of our desperation, the God of the Bible reaches down and offers us relief and refreshment. He pours out his irresistible love and rejuvenates our souls. He takes us from the barren, scorching heat of the dry and treacherous desert and rejuvenates us with streams of living water. I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never be hungry again. Whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. Jesus in John chapter 6, verse 35. Anyone who is thirsty may come to me. Anyone who believes in me may come and drink. For the scriptures declare, rivers of living water will flow from his heart. Jesus again in John chapter 7, verse 38. The Spirit and the bride say, come. Let anyone who hears this say, come. Let anyone who is thirsty, come. Let anyone who desires drink freely from the water of life. Revelation chapter 22, verse 17. Jesus promises to quench our spiritual thirst. He offers us himself in all of his splendor, glory, love, and compassion. Our longings are satisfied by his irresistible love. When we plunge into the rivers of his love, we are healed, we are forgiven, and all of our guilt and shame is washed away forever. Jesus truly is the cross in the desert, a reservoir of living hope. And that's why I call this the cross in the desert. Well, how are you planning your new year? What are your goals this year? I know every commercial I watched on cable right on the beginning of New Year was about Nutrisystem, was about losing weight. And so all of us have this problem with weight and weight control, and we try to curb our hunger. And we say, this is the new year, this is what I'm going to do. And we all start off with this beginning. It looks really promising, but we have this problem with curbing our hunger. Well, let me ask you a question. What do you have a hunger for? Hungering and thirsting for God is one of the most important goals you can have for your life. God says in Psalm 81:10, I, the Lord, am your God, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. Open your mouth wide, and I will fill it. Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 3. He humbled you and let you be hungry and fed you with manna which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Isaiah chapter 55, verse 1. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And you who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Psalm 63, verse 1. O God, you are my God. I shall seek you earnestly. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh yearns for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water. And Jesus promises, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will not hunger, and he who believes in me will never thirst. John 6:35. Now listen, God promises, if you're hungering and thirsting to know him, he promises to fill you. He promises to satisfy you. He promises to satisfy your spiritual and your physical hunger. He promises to fulfill your heart's desires. He promises to bring that hope, that freedom. He promises to wash away all of your shame and guilt. In this new year, when we are hungering and thirsting for you, O God, satisfy the hearts of all of my friends. Satisfy the longing hearts of my dear Iranian friends. Satisfy the longing hearts of my Muslim friends with your rain from heaven, with your purpose, with your person, with your goodness, with your mercy. I want to begin this new year talking to you from the heart about hungering and thirsting for God. And as you heard the word and what it promises you, I want you to think about it as you hear this very special song right now from Michael W. Smith, who tells us that everything we need, even the breath that we breathe and the air that we breathe, is a gift from our sovereign God. Let's listen to Breathe right now on the Cross in the Desert.
This is the air I breathe. This is the air I breathe. Your holy presence living in me. This is my daily bread. This is my daily bread. Your very thank you.
I'm lost without you. I'm desperate for you. Is that the cries of your heart? There is a hunger and a thirst and a longing that only Jesus can satisfy. Our hearts were made for him. Our lives were made to be satisfied and enriched by him and him alone. And this morning, as you listen to the broadcast, and if you hear God calling your heart and tugging at your heart, just respond, I am lost without you. I am desperate for you. And the promise of God is that he will fill you and he will satisfy the longings and the desperate cries of your heart. You see, that's what the cross in the desert is all about. This is a program as a voice of hope and freedom for Iranians. But what good is hope and freedom without Jesus? And you can have a new government, a new regime. You can have a new leader. And you can have freedom. But we are desperate and lost without Jesus. Freedom is just another wall without Jesus. And so this morning, I want you to know that as I begin this new year, and this is a program of voice and hope for Iranians. It is an outreach of love to Muslims. And it is about human rights, but there is something that transcends that. And that is the rights and the freedoms that we find in Jesus. And so I want you to know that's the purpose for the cross in the desert. Now I'm speaking to Christians too right now. In this new year, I got a question for you. We're talking about hungering and thirsting for God. But let me ask you as a Christian, where is your church? That's a common question that most Christians ask each other, you know. Where is your church? Where do you worship at? Where do you meet on Sunday? Well, in our culture today, most churches are built to look like shopping malls, to attract the sensitive seeker and make him feel right at home. Most churches, of course, have comfortable padded pews with the state-of-the-art video and audio technology and even come complete with cafeterias. If we're honest, most of our churches are insulated from the real world in a comfortable zone where members can be sheltered from all of the chaos and confusion. The Sunday sermon sometimes amounts to little more than a pep talk that's guaranteed to get you out in time for lunch or before the start of a major sporting event. Talk to you this morning about the church and what the church was like for 295 days or 259 days for Miriam and Marzea. They wrote a life-changing book actually 3 years ago. It was an amazing book that was life-changing for me. And they took their church outside of the box, outside of the four walls and the padded pews. They took their church to Evin Prison. You see, because that's where the broken and the hopeless are. That's where it's dangerous. That's where it's risky and inconvenient. That's where you get your hands dirty. When Jesus confronted the religious Pharisees about their hypocrisy, they confronted Jesus saying, why do you sit with the sinners and tax collectors? Why do you do that? Because Jesus is the church. And the church goes to where the broken and the hurting and the hopeless are. And those that are so self-righteous and so filled with pride can't see their own desperate condition. And so they begin confronting Jesus about hand-washing and tradition and hanging out with sinners. And yet that's exactly where you and I need to be. In this new year, let's be like Miriam and Marzea. It was also almost 3 years ago I had them right here on the cross in the desert. And they are two incredible ladies. And I know that they are busy completing their university studies, and they will write a new book about women in Islam. I'm waiting for that. But I want to take you back to their church in Evin Prison, and I want you to hear their experience when they were in prison in 2009 and how God used them and made Evin Prison their church pulpit. Let's listen right now on the cross in the desert.
The story of imprisoned pastor Saeed Abedini is focusing attention on the treatment of Christians in Iran. Now, two Iranian women are telling their persecution story.
That's right. Maryam Ross Tampour had come home from a dentist appointment and was resting on her couch when her doorbell rang. When she opened the door, her life and the life of her roommate changed forever. Wendy Griffith asked them about it.
Take us back to March 2009 when your doorbell rang. What happened?
I looked through the people and I saw Marzia with three guards. My mind was in shock. I just opened the door and they entered our apartment. They ransacked everywhere and they took both of us with all our belongings, like Bibles, books, Jesus movies, and everything that they had discovered in our apartment. And they transferred us to the security police.
For first day and especially the first week was so difficult for both of us because we were so scared. And they threatened us to physical torture. They told us that we will beat you until you vomit blood.
They sent both of us to a very small and dark and dirty cell in the basement. And every minute we were waiting for them to come and to take us for the physical torture. At that day, we just hugged each other. We said goodbye. We were thinking that it was our last day on earth.
You both could have been released at any time if you denied your faith. Why didn't you?
We are in love with Jesus, and we couldn't deny our faith. And also, because Jesus in Bible says that if you wish to follow me, you must pick up your own cross and follow me. And so as a follower of Jesus, it was very important for us to pass through this test with victory. And also it was an honor for both of us to suffer for our faith.
For 2 weeks you were in detention, both of you, and then you were moved to the notorious Evin prison. What were the conditions like?
It's awful in Evin prison. For the first 14 days we didn't have anything to eat, and even in public prison, we could eat just the bread and cheese that they gave to prisoners for breakfast, and that was all we could eat. And I was poisoned once because of the food. And, you know, the medical situation was even worse. There was just a small and dirty clinic, and we couldn't visit the doctor. For 9 months, we were both sick.
How did your faith help you keep your sanity while you were in prison?
Sometimes we couldn't pray in Farsi, our language. We couldn't find words because, you know, that situation is really scary, and our mind was in shock. And in those moments, we were just praying in tongues for each other. For example, when they took Marzia for interrogations, I was praying for her, and she did the same thing for me. And the Holy Spirit really led us in our prayers when we were praying in tongues.
We have many experiences with Jesus. We had met him, taught his love, and had seen many miracles. And our personal relationship was very important.
You know, we both believe that Evin is really the heart and brute manifestation of the power of the Ayatollahs and is really the symbol of their dominance and strength over Iran. This prison is notorious for arresting, torturing, raping, and executing of many innocents.
Some of my friends, before I got arrested, they told me, Marzia, you know about Iranian prison and Iranian government. If they rape you in prison, if they torture you, what you will do? And I always, you know, I trust God, and I always told them that I'm sure that God will protect us, but if it happened, I'm sure that God has a reason for this.
At first, you all prayed to be released, but then your prayer changed. What happened?
We had many great opportunity to talk with many prisoners, and there were many prostitutes, addicted people, and most of them were so hopeless, sad, and disappointed. We had to pray and ask God to show us the right person to talk to them. But in that prison, we had more opportunity to talk about Jesus with many women. And also about prostitutes, it was very difficult to find prostitutes in Iran because they are not in a specific place. But when we were in a prison, we find out that there are many prostitutes here, even madams. And we had a great opportunity to talk to them and pray with them. And some of them, they cry and they confess their sins. And it was really like a church for us. And every time, every day we gather and pray. And it was wonderful.
Wow. No wonder they released you.
Yeah.
We got to get these girls out of here, right?
We were more free in prison to talk about Jesus.
A wonderful testimony. They were in love with Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Jesus will give you freedom in prison.
In prison. Amen.
What a wonderful testimony.
I never tire of hearing this story because this is where the church is. This is where the church grows. This is where the power of God is. Even Miriam and Marzea, when they left, when they were released, one of the first things they did when they got back to their apartment was just get on their knees and begin praying for those still in prison that had no freedom. And they have even said many times in many interviews, you know, when we are in prison and we're under such stress, we could sense the power and presence of God so strong there. And they said, now that we're free and we're out amongst civil life again, we want that same presence again. And it's because it's so powerful. And they were put there by the Lord as an opportunity to reach people that would not have otherwise been reached. And it is amazing how God has used their testimony all over the world. And it is such a privilege to know them because these are dedicated Christians. They said it best, we are in love with Jesus. How can we deny him? I want to give you just a little bitty preview of the book I'm writing about Rahani Jabari. It's called A Beautiful Fragrance, Rahani, A Beautiful Fragrance. As I was sitting there thinking about Miriam and Marzea and what they said about prison life, this is something that you probably don't know about Rahani that I will mention in the book. Before Rahani went to prison, her mother explained this to me, Sholay. Rahani was centered in on her own life. She was motivated for her own happiness and her own achievement. So her goal was centered in on herself. And that's really not unusual. A lot of us are like that. But one of the things that bothered Rahani was homeless people. She had a
People are searching for answers, and they can't seem to find anything that matters. And you were a confused young man yourself. Take us back to Chennai. And you did not know the clear teachings of Jesus Christ. How did it all come about that you became a believer and follower of Jesus Christ?
Well, first of all, it's good to be with you, John. Known you over many years and just a delight to have our friendship. Yes, you're right. I think confusion is probably systemic in our world today, and it's not particular to any one culture, no matter where I go. In fact, the greatest percentage of our audiences is really among the young, be it universities or high schools or whatever, because that's a questioning stage in life. And there's a Chinese proverb that says, if you want to know what water is, don't ask the fish. When you're so immersed in something, oftentimes you really don't even think of a counter perspective, or you don't think of questioning what your environment is about. But the interesting thing is, you may be immersed externally in something, but internally you cannot run away from what keeps on haunting you. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, you're right, born in the city of Chennai, India. It used to be called Madras at that time, but a few years ago was changed to Chennai. Bombay was changed to Mumbai. I have to keep up with all of this. Raised in that southern city. My mother was born and raised in Chennai. My dad came from deeper south in the state of Kerala, and they met in Chennai and were married there. So my dad spoke Malayalam, my mother spoke Tamil. I was raised in Delhi and spoke Hindi. I often say I can speak Hindi and Tamil. Malayalam, I only knew the scolding words my dad used, so I don't use them in public. But Chennai was my home city till I was very young, 3 or 4, and then moved to Delhi. But the thing is, John, people don't realize that India is probably the most religious country in the world. people are pursuing answers through ceremony, through historical pursuit of tradition, and all that comes along with religion. Technically speaking, Hindu scholars will say there are 330 million deities in the pantheon of Hinduism. Now, only a handful of them are really followed very diligently by people in India. But in that culture, having had the privilege of an ancestry that went back to the highest caste of the Hindu priesthood, which was the Nambudris. My dad was from Kerala, my mom from Chennai, as I said. But I never really thought seriously about religious things. Why? I was immersed in the struggle to perform academically. India is a very competitive culture in academics. If you don't make it in your studies, you're going to go nowhere. So the pressure is on you from every side.
Big time the pressure is on students there.
Yeah, and not just enough to pass. It had to be high. You had to be right at the top of the list.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't going to make it. Cricket was in my blood. I played cricket and tennis. I loved the sports field, hated the academic side of it. And ultimately, it got me into serious trouble with my father. I wasn't going to make it. And that confusion of pursuit and the need for acceptance. Another thing about India is it's a shame-oriented culture. If you don't do that well, then you're shamed into trying to be successful. The highest rate of suicides in India is immediately after the examination results are posted in the newspapers all over the country. Kids are jumping off buildings, pouring kerosene on themselves and burning themselves. This my closest friend did this to himself. So that was really the culture within which I was born and raised and struggled. My brothers and sisters were all doing well.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
I was sort of the failure of the family, and that finally got to me.
You are listening to the voice of Ravi Zacharias as he explains why he came to faith in Christ because of his culture, because of the academic pressure. And I was really amazed to hear that after exam day or graduation day, I forgot exactly his exact words, that if people who sent their children to school were not pleased with their academic success, their children would end up putting kerosene on themselves, jumping off buildings because of the pressure to conform to this high academic standard. Well, I want to apologize to everyone. This happens every once in a while. I get disconnected from Blog Talk, have to call back in, and we have that eerie silence. And I apologize for that, but it's just part of doing live broadcasting. So as we heard there, Ravi Zacharias is kind of explaining the mood and the culture and why he came to Christ. He was very suicidal because he was not measuring up to the academic standards of his family. Now, I want you to hear Ravi's explanation of why, without Jesus, there is no hope beyond the grave. Let's listen right now on the cross in the desert.
Yeah, Jesus Christ also gives us hope beyond the grave, and without Jesus Christ, you have no hope beyond the grave. Talk about that.
This is very real. When I've attended so many different funerals in Thailand, in India, in South America, Middle East, other places. What happens when a person dies? You know, some will say just bury them before sunset and yeah, this is a ritual and so on. Others will just sit around the corpse and say nothing, there's silence. It is interesting that Oscar Wilde, who was the quintessential hedonist at his funeral, by the way, which was held in the same church in Paris where Pascal's funeral was held, you know, to do the research and find out there was no music. Imagine in a pleasure-driven life, there was really no music at that funeral. And on his gravestone is a verse from the book of Job. Hope is something we all long for. And John, it's important that the listener follow this. Not only because I want to find meaning beyond the grave, but if there is no life beyond the grave, what happens to justice? What happens to the person who has committed atrocities and then just puts a bullet to his or her head? And is this all over? is there no balance to be set straight afterwards. So hope is not just a particular need in my life for me to see life beyond the grave or to see my loved ones again. It has to do with the quintessential question of justice as well. In Jesus Christ, this is the most beautiful thing about the gospel, the resurrection from the dead, the transformation of three lives, Thomas, who sees the risen Lord, ho kurios mou, ho theos mou, my Lord and my God, the transformation of Saul of Tarsus to the Apostle Paul, who writes one third of the New Testament, and then his brother James. Hope beyond the grave redefines everything. Billy Graham was talking to Konrad Adenauer once. As Adenauer was looking out of the window, Dr. Graham told us the story around the table. And Konrad Adenauer looked at him and said, Mr. Graham, do you really believe Jesus Christ rose again from the dead? And Billy Graham said, Mr. Adenauer, if I didn't, I would have no gospel to preach. He said there was silence. And then Konrad Adenauer said, you know, Mr. Graham, outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind. And to those of you who are listening to me, the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead is defining for everything. Let me just say one more thing to you about that. If Jesus were a charlatan, do you know what he would have said? He would have said, I will spiritually rise again. How do you falsify that after you find the body? He said, no, I am bodily going to rise again. That bodily resurrection was the concrete empirical evidence and the genuineness of the sincerity of the truth of Jesus Christ. I know when I die, I will be with him and also be with my loved ones who have known him and trusted him. Trust him where you are. He gives you hope not only for the future, hope for now, meaning for now, and the moral ground on which to define your life. You see, ultimately the problem is not morality. Jesus Christ didn't come into this world to make bad people good. He came into this world to make dead people live. We are dead to God. He makes us alive to him. You can find that hope in him.
Wow. Those words are absolutely true. We were dead in our trespasses and sins, Ephesians chapter 2 says. When Jesus comes, he makes us spiritually alive. Remember the series you see, I think it's HBO, The Walking Dead. Well, this is a great analogy of what mankind is, the walking spiritual dead. And so if you look at that series, and it's such a popular series, I've never watched it, I've heard about it. This is a great analogy to what Ravi is saying. Most of mankind, physically alive, spiritually dead, they're like the walking dead. And when Jesus comes into your heart and soul, he makes you spiritually alive again to God. And so it's very true, there is no hope without Jesus. But what about who Jesus is? I mean, isn't he just one way among many good ways? Isn't he just a prophet? Let's hear Ravi Zacharias once again talk about what about Jesus and who he claimed to be.
A student asked, could you please expand on how Jesus might respond to the Baha'i faith, that all religions are one, and that Jesus is just one of many prophets?
You know, coming from the East, John, we just plague each other with questions. I mean, that's the way it is. If you do an open forum in Delhi, for example, or in Mumbai, or in Chennai, you will find you'll never get out of there. They have very many questions. It's a questioning culture, and it's also true in the Middle East, and that's why I think religious ideas are so central to their ethos and their pathos, and they feel it so passionately. So the first thing I want to say is to the listener, I understand how you feel about these issues for two reasons. Number one, it's a genuine question. Number two, it's connected to family and to ancestral beliefs. And so when they raise questions on exclusivity, for example, or on the Baha'i faith, which is syncretistic, I know why they are asking this. But the Baha'i faith, you know, coming up in the mid-1800s, a little after the 1850s and so on, that particular faith by the Islamic worldview is treated as heretical and people are persecuted unfortunately so. Their intention was noble, to try to bring everybody together. So if you go, for example, to the Baha'i Temple in Delhi, or where I'm sure you've even been there, massive edifices and so on, there's a fundamental problem with that. All religions simply cannot be true. So I've heard people say religions are all fundamentally the same and only superficially different. Skeptics normally say that. It's the opposite. They are fundamentally different and at best only superficially similar. Islam is not the same as Hinduism. Christianity is not the same as Islam. We need to be cordially able to interact on these issues without anathematizing each other, but holding on to truth. Truth is ultimately incontrovertible. Why can't all religions be true? Because the law of non-contradiction applies to reality. Two contradictory statements, meaning opposite things, cannot both be correct at the same time. Exclusivity is a reality in truth, because truth is primarily a property of propositions. We see this in a courtroom. Were you in the room when this took place? The answer is either yes or no. You can say one foot in there, one foot out of there. You can play word games, but the questioner is looking for truth. Truth, by definition, is exclusive. So when Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes unto the Father except through me, it's an audacious claim. It's a dramatic claim. It's an absolute claim. The question is, can it be sustained by his life, teaching, and so on? That's what we have to ask. All religions simply cannot be the same. Gautama Buddha was born a Hindu, and he renounced two of the fundamental doctrines of Hinduism. He did not accept the authority of the Vedas, and he did not accept the caste system. That's why even in recent times, there were people coming in saying, in a move from A over to B, where we don't have a caste system. But those two beliefs he renounced, and that's when his four noble truths and this eightfold path came into being. Islam is not the same as Sikhism. Sikhism is not the same as Hinduism. There are doctrines and claims that are made that are exclusive to every faith. Every faith has its exclusivity. Even Baha'ism, which claims to be syncretistic, actually excludes the exclusivists and says you can't be an exclusivist and be a follower of the Baha'i faith at the same time. It's the nature of what truth is. So rather than getting upset at an exclusive claim, reason tells me, let me examine these claims and see if they stand the test of truth. That's what we need to do.
Folks, I also want you to know there's a whole lot more that Ravi has said on this question and all of these that we're presenting during this program. Go to Ravi Zacharias. Just Google him. You'll come to his website. Go to him on YouTube. You can see his lectures and answering these questions in different parts of the world. You can hear thousands and thousands of students gathering that have asked questions to him, and he's stood there patiently answering these questions. So just take it from me. There's a lot of information there.
Such an important verse that Ravi quoted from. This is really my life verse, where Jesus says, I am the way and the truth and the life. And I love the way that Ravi explained very well and very adequately from the law of non-contradictions how all religions cannot be the same. And this is a cultural cow. And this is what the skeptic likes to say because he wants to feel comfortable in his own religion. And so if there is another one out there that is actually standing up against his claim, he doesn't want to hear that. Well, the words of Jesus, once and for all, the exclusive claims of Christ, attack this norm that all religions are the same. And Jesus did not say, you're all welcome no matter what you believe. There's many pathways to God. No, Jesus very clearly answering the question of Thomas, show us the way. Jesus says, I am. And that is the divine title for God. I am Yahweh. I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. What do you do with that claim? Oh, I've seen people do word gymnastics with that, trying to re-explain and reinterpret what Jesus says. But this is an exclusive claim, and I'd like to say it this way to you. If you're lost, Jesus is the way. If you're searching for answers, Jesus is the truth. If you want real life, Jesus is the life. He claims to satisfy that hunger. He claims to answer your questions. He claims to do all of those things. And what my would tell you is to investigate and to study who he is and see if you don't come to the same conclusion. Well, there's more from Ravi Zacharias. Ravi is going to talk now to the skeptic that says, well, you know, I don't see any real need for God in the world. I don't even believe that there is a God. Well, what's the problem with that statement? Here is Ravi Zacharias talking about the idea of no God means there's no absolutes. Let's listen right now to The Cross in the Desert.
You say that there are four things that we are going to miss if we leave God out of our life, if we think that we can live without God. Let's take those four things. What's the first one?
The first one is an absence of a point of reference for moral decision making. There is no more an ontic referent, as the philosopher will say. There is no more objective truth. There's no more an absolute. Let me give an illustration to the listener. For example, I come from India, where traffic is the topic of songs. You know, they say you live here in Bombay and it's dodge and bob and weave and all of that. But when you come to a red light, what is it telling you? Stop. Now, some people might think it's telling them it's Christmas and they keep going, but it's actually to tell you to stop. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're at that stoplight and you're daydreaming a bit and you see the car in the next lane and you're wondering whether he's moving or you're moving, what is it you really do at that moment? Instinctively, you go for the brake because the light is red, you can't move. Now, when you are not sure after you put your foot on the brake whether you're moving or the other person is moving, what do you do next? You look out of the window, look for a tree or look for a building, that which is not supposed to move, and measure yourself by that. Now, that is the indicator of an absolute, something that is immovable. I like to give another illustration. It's a clockmaker in Leicester, England, who found this man stopping outside his shop every day, synchronizing his watch with the clock. So one day he looked at the man, he said, what do you do this every day for? He said, well, I'm embarrassed to tell you this. I'm the timekeeper in the factory nearby. At 4 o'clock, I have to ring the bell every afternoon. At the end of the day, my watch doesn't work very well, so I synchronize it with your clock every morning. And the clockmaker says, that's really funny, sir, because actually my clock doesn't work very well either. I adjust it with the bell from the factory at 4 o'clock every afternoon when I hear the bell ringing. What happens when two wrong watches are synchronizing themselves with each other? One will have to pardon the grammar, but they'll get wronger and wronger every time. When there's nothing immovable, when you're synchronizing it with that which itself is such as a reciprocal way of doing things, you will end up with a culture in total chaos. There's no absolute. There's no point of reference. That is precisely the moral framework. And there's one statement I will never forget from Auschwitz, walking through from room to room and seeing Hitler's statement outside the gas chambers, which said, I want to raise a generation of young people devoid of a conscience, imperious, relentless, and cruel. That, to me, is the logical outworking of relativism. And those who trumpet the triumph of relativism have to realize that is the slippery slope on which we step when we do away with the absolute.
Well said, Ravi, because that's what's our culture. It really is. The truth decay, if you will, of our culture is relativism. Relativism means there are no absolutes. Well, the problem with that statement is there's at least one absolute. You're saying there are no absolutes, so it's really self-refuting. And I think he made his point well with the quote from Auschwitz, wow, that's the culture that you and I live in. And it's not so much a lack of evidence for people, it's because their life is so important to them, that individual that believes that way, that if they believe that Christianity is true, then they no longer would be the captain of their own life, are in charge of their own life. So it is a moral problem more than an intellectual problem or a problem because of lack of evidence for God's existence. And in this last soundbite with Ravi, this is really based on his book, Can Man Live Without God, his first really important book. And he is going to talk to us right now that without God, life has no meaning. Let's listen on The Cross in the Desert.
Ravi, we're talking about can man live without God. If people choose to live as if God doesn't exist, there are ramifications. Give us a summary of where we're at, and let's continue.
The question that I think is the reigning question of our time. All the others are really footnotes to this question. Can man live without God? And I did actually two lectures in Q&A, and the third one, I had other panelists join me from the student body. It was a fascinating third session and then went into print as a book, Can Man Live Without God? My four points were that, and I think there are actually a lot more, but if you take just these four that define our lives, I said the loss of a point of reference for moral absolutes, that you really are governing your own life by whatever your conscience tells you or what your intuition tells you. Now, the problem with that is, in a world with so many different cultures, so many different religious perspectives, so many different forms of education, you're on a collision course at that point, because what is good for one may be a cursed thing to another and vice versa. So we need to have a moral absolute that is objectively true for all of us. Is it objectively true to say, I have no right to take a sword and lop off another person's head and do that with my own moral precepts and my own prerogatives and do it on display in public television and consider that a triumphalist thing? Is that morally right or wrong? What does our intuition say to us? Chances are somebody listening is going to say, you know, it's okay if it's revenge done by someone. Someone else is going to say, no, it's a horrific thing that you've done. What is the transcending point of reference to which we can point? Is it morally abhorrent to torture a baby for your own pleasure? And if so, where do we get that objective moral value from? So the fact of the matter is, we need an objective standard by which we point. Scientifically speaking, you can't have your own law of gravity, and I have my own law of gravity. You have your own law of thermodynamics, and I have my own laws of thermodynamics. No, there are specific laws and precepts that are given. So it is in a moral universe, which is what this world is. So we need that objectivity. Secondly, the question of meaning. Now, this becomes obviously more subjective, but not as readily as you may think so. Let me tell you why. Recently, a founder of an atheistic society against religion passed away. As you and I are speaking right now, it just happened a few days before. And interestingly enough, she was an atheist, followed the Bertrand Russell dictum that when she was put into the soil, her body was going to rot. That's what prompted her daughter to make the statement that for my mother, because death is the end and the body rots, therefore, life is precious. Now, I found that fascinating. That's not what she was actually meaning. What she meant was her life was precious because she raised millions of dollars in the obliteration of other lives in the womb. And so I say, if you really think life is precious, what prompted you to fund the elimination of thousands of... Now, I know those are painful questions, but it is a legitimate question when somebody makes the statement that life is precious. So I believe life is precious, but I believe all of life is precious because all of life has intrinsic value, not extrinsic value given by government or state or culture. Now, the only way we can talk about intrinsic worth is if we are created by God Himself, an entity of essential worth. Life can only have meaning and purpose if life has essential value and then has purpose and significance. So I think these two realities for the non-theist or the atheist or the anti-theist are really unanswerable questions. Oh, I know they try to answer them, that we have to live and let live. you've seen what tolerance has done in our time. What it really means is A's view is valuable, B's is dispensable. No, no. In a true world of tolerance and acceptance, we have to respect each other's views and dialogue on that meaningfully, because life is meaningful. So I believe in knowing Jesus Christ, He who is my Savior, who laid down His life for me and was willing to offer love and forgiveness for me, who never even sought after Him, but He pursued me, quote, like the hound of heaven. And there in that hospital bed, as I tried to take my life, found out that my life was meaningful not because I was an A student or a B student or a C student, but my life was meaningful because I was a creature created imago Dei, in the image of God. My moral reasoning and my essential worth comes to me from my Creator. That alone enables me to pursue His purpose and His pattern and His design for my life.
I think, without a doubt, and I hope that you would agree with me on this, that Ravi Zacharias is a modern-day example of C.S. Lewis. His thinking, his reasoning, his humility is truly just shines so brightly. And when you read C.S. Lewis and you hear and you reason with his arguments, I know that he was impacted by C.S. Lewis. And that's why I say I don't like to make comparisons, but if I had to say that we have an example of a modern-day C.S. Lewis, Ravi Zacharias is at the top of the list. What a wonderful broadcast this has been today to hear from a man of God that takes as much time as necessary to answer the questions of the skeptics. I see him standing in auditoriums, taking his time, answering the questions from young people, from old people, on the subject of life and religion, etc. He is a master apologist. Thank you so much, Mary. You're right. And I thank everyone that had a chance to hear him. Please listen again. Please listen to what he has to say. He is a voice of hope for a culture of truth decay. As we've been talking about meaning and purpose, we've been talking about a foundation that Jesus gives. I want us to hear this song by Hillsong. Jesus is the cornerstone, right now on the cross in the desert.
But holy trust in Jesus' name.
of Hillsong worship music is called Cornerstone. Jesus is our finisher, the author and the finisher of our faith. That's right, Mary, exactly. He is the meaning and purpose for our life. He is the foundation for everything. That is Jesus. Just the other day, I was on Telegram chatting with my good friend Sharzad. Sharzad is the sister of Rahane, the book I'm writing. And Rahane met Morteza Sarbandi the day that changed her entire destiny in life. She met him at an ice cream parlor just outside of Tehran. And I was asking some questions of Sharzad, and she promised to go and take a picture of this ice cream parlor that's still today, because the next chapter in my book is called The Spring Day at the Ice Cream Parlor, the day that changed Rahane's destiny and life forever. And Sharzad came back later and said, "Sorry, Randy, I couldn't take the picture. There was so much commotion because of the embassy attack. It's close to the area where the ice cream parlor is at." And so I said, "Oh, of course, I understood. You know what happened if you've been following the news." And of course, this happened 37 years ago when the American embassy was attacked in Tehran and Americans were taken hostage. Just because of a Sunni cleric that was executed in Saudi Arabia, the Iranians stormed the Saudi Arabian embassy and have caused so much death and destruction. And I find this extremely hypocritical with such a double standard. Why? Because Shias, Iranian Shias, the government, kills Sunnis every day in Iran. There are Sunnis on death row in Iran that are going to be executed. They do this every day, but now the Shias are up in arms because one of their own was killed by Sunnis. Very sad situation. And you may ask, please explain to me Sunni and Shia distinction. What is this all about? Well, here to help me do that is my very good friend, the lady that writes for my program, my goddaughter. I call her that affectionately. Her name is Peymoneh. This is her first story of 2016, and she is going to explain to you the differences between Sunnis and Shias and explain what's going on here in Iran. And I'm going to read this new story from Peymoneh for you. People still remember the picture a little girl drew of her father being hanged by the Islamic regime of Iran. Her father was not a criminal. His crime was his religion, his belief, and his faith. But he did not believe in Christ or any other god not accepted by the regime. He believed in the regime's very god Allah. Yes, he was a Muslim like the majority of the Muslims in the world. But the Iranian regime that is based on Shia is certain that none of those Sunni Muslims will ever go to paradise. That is why they call Sunni people Sunni dogs and behead them like they would behead dogs. I hope you know how this regime treats dogs. They shoot at dogs, inject poison in their bodies, and kill them in any cruel way because, like these dogs are unclean for them, so are the Sunnis. Yes, in their eyes, Sunni people are not human beings. They have no rights. They do not deserve to be treated like a living creature. They don't mind that they believe in the same Allah and follow their same prophet Muhammad. Sunnis will not go to paradise because they do not follow their dear sinless Imam Ali, the son-in-law and cousin of the prophet Muhammad, whom they believe, that is, Shias believe, was the legitimate successor of Muhammad. Sunni Muslims will not go to paradise because they do not believe in religious leaders after Muhammad, but only the leaders of society. Even Sunnis' three kafif are rulers named Abakar, Omar, and Osman, whose Sunnis followed after Muhammad are not considered sinless by their followers and were the only the leaders of Muslim societies. In Shia understanding, the Imam Ali is considered sinless. Since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, the only common thing the regime had with Sunni Muslims was the Unity Week, showing that Shias and Sunnis are brothers to hide their hate of Sunnis behind this phrase. but hundreds of these Shia brothers have been killed by them so far. Of course, they are not killed in the name of Sunni, but in different reasons considered as criminals. They are thieves, drug dealers, murderers, and mohabari, that is enmity with God, corruption on earth, and propaganda against the system, all these different charges made against them. It is not an exaggeration when we say the regime's henchmen call and treat Sunnis like they do with dogs. They killed them in the Kurdish areas. They torture them to death. They let them starve, torture them, and deprive them of medical treatment. They hurt them and cause injuries leading to infection and leave them without any medical care. They hang Sunni children, as they do with a lot of other children. Recently, a number of Sunni prisoners died in prison due to torture, lack of medical treatment, and maybe other reasons we do not know yet or will never know. Some of them, as well as one child, are on death row right now. They do not only kill prisoners, they kill their oppressed and suppressed family souls and the whole Sunni societies. They kill humanity. They do not mind if all Sunnis in Iran die because these people do not agree with the Shia government in Iran, because the Islamic government in Iran are hated by many Sunni people all around the world. They do not mind if all Sunnis as well as Christians and Baha'is die. It is their plan. It is their dream to wipe everybody out who do not agree with them all around the world, because the leader of the regime is considered as God's representative on the earth, and anyone who does not accept him, that is the supreme leader, is considered the enemy of God. The regime might not be able to work all over the world, but they will control the country they conquered and some other countries here and there. And they will pay for it. They will pay their nation's absolute rights, their nation's human rights, to take the absolute right away from their opponents, everyone who does not support them. In the Islamic regime eyes, dogs are dirty animals that deserve to die. And Sunnis, like many other people in Iran, like many young men and women in the streets, like many educated and thoughtful people in prisons, deserve to be kicked out of the world and killed like dogs. For them, Sunnis, like many other people, do not feel pain, do not have emotions, do not get hungry or even sick. Even if they have these senses, the regime does not mind, because Sunnis, like many other people, do not need to live like the average human being. We want the Iranian regime to ask themselves this very important question: how many people did Jesus kill or even hurt with his power? Or how many did his 12 disciples hurt with the power given to them? The answer, of course, is none. Thank you, dear Payman A, for educating us about why the Shias hate and kill Sunnis. And again, why should they be outraged at the death and execution of a Shia cleric? Why? The Shias kill Sunnis every day, but they can't tolerate the death of one of their own. What hypocrisy, and what a double standard. Well, today on the cross in the desert, I asked a very, very important question. What are you hungering and thirsting for in the new year? What is your goal, your ambition? This is a very important question, because as I illustrated, most of us are preoccupied with weight loss, with taking care of that hunger that we have, trying to curb that hunger. But what are you doing with the real physical hunger? What are you hungering and thirsting for? As I talk with many, many Muslims, I find that there is a real ambition they have to please Allah so that they are worthy and have the assurance that when they die, they will go to paradise. And so often, many, many Muslims are told by their imams, make priority, prayer a priority. Pray, because Allah is keeping track of your prayer time. He's counting the points. You see, in Islamic theology, Allah is like a great businessman keeping track of how much you fast, how much you pray, how many points that you have earned. Because when you don't have a Savior in your system, then salvation is up to you. And I find with not only Muslims, but anyone that are on the treadmill of performance, to have enough points earned at the end of time to please their God. It's like the rewards card you have with Walgreens. How many points have you accrued through purchases? Do you have enough? Do you know the Bible presents a radically different picture? The Bible gives you and me assurance. Assurance that all is well with our soul. That we have a salvation that is secure. That is not based on our performance, but based on the performance of one who died and rose again, namely Jesus. You see, Christianity, this love relationship with God, is not based on performance and points. It's based on Jesus and what he did. In 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3, Peter says, "All praise to God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. It is by his great mercy that we have been born again. Because God raised Jesus from the dead, now we live. And through your faith, God is protecting you by his power until you receive this salvation, which is ready to be revealed on the last day for all to see. So, be truly glad. There is wonderful joy ahead. Even though you have to endure many trials for a little time, these trials will show that your faith is genuine. It is being tested as fire tests and purifies gold. Through your faith is far more precious than mere gold." Wow. This is a statement of absolute assurance. Our inheritance cannot change or decay. Priceless inheritance that is kept, that is reserved in heaven. It is not based on our performance. You see, that's the New Year resolution for many, many of us, the treadmill of performance. But this salvation has been bought and paid for by Jesus, who lived a sinless, perfect life, kept God's law perfectly. And that is why we are given a precious gift, a perfect gift of righteousness, that we can stand before God without fear, without shame. Gift for you and me, earned by one who was perfect and sinless and kept God's law. And we certainly fail to glorify God in our thought, word, and deed. We could never keep his law if it was based on our performance. Peter could never say what he just said. It's an inheritance. You get that when you die. It is a full, perfect inheritance reserved in heaven where there is no decay or change. The message of love and assurance, the message that Muslims need to hear. Listen to me. I know there are many gifted writers that write books, that talk about radical Islam, that talk about their means, their motives, that talk about the violence, they talk about what Muhammad did and did not do. And most of these books somehow we absorb. And when we meet Muslims, we somehow erect this barrier between us and them. And what I'm trying to say to you is the message that Muslims need to hear is the message of God's unconditional love and the assurance that when they meet Christ through faith, that all of their shame and guilt is taken away. I'm not saying there is not a room for a debate. Gifted apologists like Nabil Qureshi debate every day. But what I am saying is the message that we need to give to Muslims in this new year is what I just read to you. This is a message of hope and assurance that the Muslim man or woman can have. Because they are taught that it's based on everything that they do in the religious ritual that they are taught in Islam. When we talk about violence and Muhammad and radical Islam, this creates a barrier for what the real message needs to be. They don't have a God of love in Islam. When you read the Quran, the love that's spoken of there is based on your merit. It's based on how you live. It is an earned love. I write about this in my book, The Cross in the Desert. And there is a story that my Muslim friend told me that prompted this. She said that when she went to school in Iran, that the teacher would talk to them about the hijab, wearing their veil, their burqa, their chador. And she says, for every girl who does not wear hijab, at the end of their life, in the judgment, Allah will dangle them by their hair over the fires of hell. So fear is what motivates Muslims. And yet the Bible says this kind of fear is a slavish fear that leads to destruction. There is a true fear of God in reverence, but not the kind of fear that I just explained to you about the teacher. The Bible presents a God of absolute, unconditional love who stretches out his arms to a race of people that deserve his judgment and wrath, but he stretches out his arms of love and forgiveness. This is the message that Muslims need to hear. They need to hear that the God that we serve does not have a list of requirements for them to do, not a list of duties. Instead, he welcomes them as they are. Not because they're good, but because Jesus took everything that stood in their way, nailed it to his cross, and forgave them. And on that basis, God welcomes Muslims from every tribe, tongue, and nation into his kingdom because of Jesus, because of his perfection, because of his absolute love. When you read about Jesus, when you see the way he treated women, Muslims want to know more about this man who said, "Blessed are they that hunger and thirst for righteousness." At his perfect time to talk to her about her need. We've been friends for a while, and I want to just tell you that our witness as Christians sometimes goes beyond just words. It's how we treat people. And so in this new year, as I look at what I'm doing here, and I think about who I'm talking to, my message is a message of absolute assurance and forgiveness in Jesus. This is the hope and freedom that Iranians and Muslims need. As I've said before, human rights are very, very important. I will continue to be a voice for their human rights. But the real freedom and the hope is not in a new government, as good as that might be. It is not in anything or anyone but a person, Jesus. You know, at Christmas time, as usual, the Iranian regime rounded up many Christians in the house church movement. And many of these Christians are suffering in prisons. being denied proper medical care, being tortured and interrogated and forced to try to recant their faith. But these Christians that meet secretly in house churches have found a hope and freedom that is secure in God's arms of love, a salvation that cannot change or fade away. And so when they are tortured and they are interrogated, and they probably remember these words of Peter, these trials are just going to strengthen and purify you, because you have a salvation that is secure in heaven, pure and undefiled, that cannot change or decay. Now that's a salvation worth dying for. That's a salvation worth the trials and the tortures that you're going through. That is something to hold on to that is priceless. And so I want to thank you so much for being a part of this ministry of outreach of hope and freedom to Iranians. I want to thank everyone in the chat room today, from Mary to Patricia to Lion, to all of you that I don't know by name. Thank you so much for being a part of this ministry to give hope and freedom to Muslims and Iranians all over the world. I want to say Happy New Year to every one of you. And in this new year, if you have never accepted Jesus, come to him and say, Jesus, show me the truth. Open my eyes. Show me your love. Show me your forgiveness. I guarantee you, he will answer that prayer. I want to say God bless everyone, and I will see you this Thursday on the next Cross in the Desert.